Welcome everybody to today's panel discussion. We will have a panel discussion on QFT versus beyond QFT approaches to quantum gravity. And specifically, I've asked the panelists to start an opening statement either advocating for QFT approaches and explaining why beyond or which aspects of beyond QFT approaches might be problematic, or exactly the other way around, advocating for beyond QFT approaches and pointing out which aspects of quantum field theory might be problematic. And the main goal of this discussion would be to pinpoint like key differences and key difficulties in both of these frameworks, but also see which ingredients might be shared nevertheless. And finally, if we find like physical observables or like signatures that would tell us that whether quantum gravity is a QFT or not. And of course, like the question of, or the definition of a quantum field theory is not uniquely defined, so we will see several different definitions of what a quantum field theory is or what already is not a quantum field theory anymore. As the general structure, we will start with opening statements. Then I encourage discussion between the panelists about their opening statements. And then finally, there will be some time for questions from the audience. To introduce the panel, we start on the far side. From me, it's Luca, who already gave a talk in the morning. And Luca is an expert on non-local quantum gravity and non-local field theories more generally. Then we have Benjamin, who is an expert in asymptotically safe quantum gravity and FRG computations, and also like in like form factors and in form factors and momentum dependence in quantum gravity. Then we have Kasia, who is has like a big like great background on algebraic quantum field theories, and also some papers on causal sets and like applying quantum field theory techniques to causal sets. Then we have Pedro, who works on string theory and is an like expert on the conformal bootstrap. And finally, we have Lee, who is currently sitting over there, but will join us here later, who I guess...
where the bad guys sit.
Who is, I mean, I guess everybody knows his contributions to loop quantum gravity.
Yeah, but that wasn't so good. Everybody's going to tell me.
Okay, so... with this, Luca, please start your opening statement, and once you're done with your opening statement, pass the clicker down this side.
All right. Okay, thank you very much, Mark. So let's be quick. So the questions that I was asked to address are the following. Why QFT approaches are the most promising approaches to quantum gravity, and what challenges you see for beyond QFT approaches? Now, I will mainly say focus on one, let's say, QFT approach, which is just perturbative QFT approach to quantum gravity. And since I'm not an expert of like other quantum field theory approaches, I will only mention something and pose a question for other approaches. So that's the idea. And basically, I will repeat a bit what I also said, maybe in some of the things I said in the open discussion before. But here, I would like just to tell more or less the same, but in a, like if I was telling a story, okay? So let's just start. We know that Einstein general relativity, we have heard already many times that general relativity as a QFT fails to be perturbatively renormalizable, and this is one theoretical issue. But also observationally, for instance, if you want to try to understand the limitation of this theory, you can ask, okay, can we try to explain, for instance, physics in the early universe cosmology just with this gravitational action? Of course, that's not possible because we need an extra ingredient. And phenomenologically, we know that we can write down models that work, for instance, that can explain new physics beyond standard GR. For instance, if we just add some inflaton action, we can describe the early universe cosmology. So the idea here is just not to talk about quantum gravity without any relation to experiment, but trying to also make some contact with the experiment and see where we go. So, of course, we have a simplest model. So the question is, now, from a theoretical perspective, is there any way, like, in which we can, from fundamental principle, say, we can really write down a Lagrangian, and with this Lagrangian, see whether we can also try to explain new physics beyond Einstein general relativity, like, for instance, early universe cosmology. So this is the question. And of course, at least if you work in the framework of perturbative quantum field theory, we have guiding principle that we have been using, for instance, to select Lagrangians in the standard model of particle physics. There, what we usually do, of course, we assume symmetries, locality, but one principle which is very, very restrictive is the one of renormalizability, or better, strict renormalizability. And we know that all the electroweak and QCD interaction are described by strictly renormalizable Lagrangian in the framework of perturbative QFT. So the question to ask is, can we do the same for GR? Can we extend it in the same way we extend Fermi theory to some strictly renormalizable theory by adding extra ingredient? Can we do the same also for gravity, Einstein general relativity? The answer is yes, of course we can do that. And so from fundamental principle, we get from, I say, same principle that we use for the interaction, we apply them also for gravity, and we get something which is strictly renormalizable. And actually, what I find very interesting here is that for free, you also get an extra ingredient that can be used, for instance, to explain that new physics that GR was not able to explain. Indeed, this extra term in the Lagrangian, which is the R squared term, is very good to explain inflation. Okay, and you see, you need a coefficient which is of the order of 10 to the 10. So you see, just by working the framework of perturbative quantum theory, we are able to still understand some feature of gravity, which actually can be also useful to describe new physics, which goes beyond Einstein general relativity. I don't want to discuss like open issues about this theory and so on. I want just to say that by working the perturbative QFT framework, we get something which is somehow successful. So for me, I know this is very biased opinion, but this fact that I've just said is, for me, a success of the perturbative QFT framework applied to gravitational interaction. And one thing I would like to highlight here is that, for instance, if you make a comparison with the effective field theory of GR, usually this R square and value square term, they can be removed usually with some field definition because we imagine that these coefficients are order one or small. But in a renormalizable theory, this coefficient can be large. So here we are getting some deviation from GR, let's say, which is not happening at the Planck scale. It's happening at much lower scale because you only need like scale of the order of 10 to the 13 GB to explain new physics. So somehow from a perturbative quantum field theory approach applied to gravity, we can describe physics much below Planck scale. And I find this very, very successful. And of course, as I said, I'm not an expert of other approaches, but I would like to hear, for instance, if we compare this just standard renormalizable quantum gravity approach to string theory or Swoboda scenario, whether we can really discriminate between the two, because from my understanding, in string theory and Swoboda, you also have this high-order curvature correction, but the coefficients of this have to be thought like effective field theory expansion, where the coefficients are small. So you cannot really explain, for instance, inflation in the same way we do here. And so the more general question is like, does any beyond QFT approach do better than perturbative QFT in the sense of having like a unique Lagrangian, because that's a unique Lagrangian that you get in D equal to 4 if you ask strict normalizability. Simplicity, so just by relying on very conservative fact that we have been using also for the interaction. New physics beyond GR, like no conjectures besides some standard principle, I would say. And no problem also with matter couplings, because at least you can couple matter in quantum field theory and then see what happens. And also you have good methods, I would say, to perform quantitative computation until they can be trusted. So just as a comment, in my opinion, there is no perfect theory, okay? So the only thing we can do is, like, given our, as I said, theoretical understanding and experimental understanding, what is the simplest theory that we can write down, and which is the simplest framework we can use it. And for me, at least up to my understanding, this is the simplest thing we can do. And of course, we can make then things more complicated by adding like no perturbative effects on the top of that and so on. But up to here, okay, at least maybe it's just my ignorance, but I don't see any approach beyond QFT that can do as good as this perturbative, standard perturbative QFT approach. So with this, I will pass my, you call it this, I don't know, my pointer to Benjamin.
Thank you very much, Luca. Now Benjamin is next.
Thank you very much. As you know, the question is, can quantum gravity be a QFT or not? And I would say resounding yes, from what I've seen so far. And the reason is, there are a couple of reasons. So why I think that we should not really give up on QFT. As Luca has mentioned, QFT is an extremely predictive and a quantitative framework. We can do computations with it, and they agree with the real world. Take the standard model. The standard model has some of the most precise predictions in all of physics, in all of science, actually. We have numerous examples there. Think of the electron anomalous magnetic moment, where we have like 10 digits and they all agree. So theory agrees with experiment. So that's a remarkable feat. And if you want to give up on QFT, you have to work hard to get to that level of precision and agreement with the real world, I think. The second point that is very closely connected to quantum field theory, and that I also mentioned in this discussion before a little bit, is the concept of universality, right? The independence of microscopic details happening via second order phase transition, which can be a very useful tool in quantum gravity, because we really don't want that, let's say we have some space-time atoms that are maybe cubes, and they give you prediction A, and then you change the cubes into something deformed, and suddenly you get some prediction B, which is completely different. So universality in the connection with QFT saves you from that, usually. The third point that I want to make is that of effective field theory, which once again plays into the same direction. These are very specific QFTs, and they just work extremely well for everything that we know so far. So I find it really hard to give up the framework of QFT. The second point is that quantum gravity itself, of course, must be consistent with a lot of constraints. Once again, we touched upon that in the previous discussion. You have to get out a standard model. You have to get out a bunch of masses that agree with the measurements. You cover couplings. You name it. You have to get out cosmology, right? There's a lot of things that you have on the table. If you want to give up QFT and want to build quantum gravity from scratch, there's a lot that you have to reproduce first. And in a QFT setup, at least in many that I know, it's kind of for free, right? So at least if you think, for example, of asymptotic safety, effective field theory is built in. And you don't have to show that you get GR in the infrared, because it's just there. A third point that I want to make is that of non-perturbativity. So often we think of QFT as very closely connected to perturbation theory, or even only making sense in a perturbative setting. But then I would argue that we know that, for example, QCD is very non-perturbative in the infrared, and we are fine with that. We have lattice methods. We have other methods to make predictions also there. And QFT is not the issue. We just have to work harder than perturbation theory. And then we can still manage. And also, I should mention, there are models of 4D QFTs where you can have asymptotic safety perturbatively. So you have complete control over the fixed point in a perturbative regime. So also this concept of only strictly, asymptotic freedom is the only game in town, I think it's not right. So the point that I want to make here is that if we accept that non-perturbativity is just part of QFT, then we should also accept that it happens in quantum gravity, and maybe look how far we can get with that idea. Now you can ask, of course, why haven't we been successful yet with finding a QFT of quantum gravity? QFT is around for a long time now, so why are we meeting? Why are we not done yet? And I think part of the story is that there's, of course, a non-QFT approach, string theory, and they vastly outnumber QFT approaches in people power. And it's, and I think this is just an often heard criticism from string theory that they claim they are the only game in town. But I think it's not really fair if you compare how many people have worked on string theory and how many have worked on alternatives to string theory. One other aspect of this is also many modern tools have only been recently developed. There are new ideas that have been recently developed. And also there's a question of computational power if you think of lattice methods like CDT. And they just haven't existed like 50 years ago, right? So to mention some, the functional renormalization group as a non-perturbative realization of DRG, we know about it since like the mid to late 90s. Large-scale computation, computer simulations, I mean, these are improving basically year by year, right? With increasing computational power, we can do larger and larger simulations and also then more realistic simulations. And the third thing is, of course, new ideas, non-local quantum gravity is just a new avenue, a new way of looking at things. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Benjamin. And Kasia is next.
All right. I think we had enough of QFT is the best approach, so let's start the transition. So I'm a bit in the middle, and I come from mathematical physics. I come from quantum field theory, so I've seen the best and the worst of it. And this is my personal view, really. So the way I kind of went from really very QFT to more and more beyond QFT, actually. So, I mean, the idea, of course, is very simple with, you know, treating quantum gravity as a QFT, and people tried it and encountered various obstructions. So the idea is, of course, we take some background metric, we perturb it, and we want to quantize it as a quantum field. So the first thing that people noticed that put them off somewhat was that the theory was power counting non-renormalizable, and at the time, that was a big oh no. But right now, I guess it's clear that, of course, we can do things as effective theory and get interesting predictions. So it was already discussed yesterday, and this is how I actually entered this whole field by, thinking about effective theory on curved spacetime. So that was my first kind of point of approach at quantum gravity. But then you can ask yourself, well, that's not great. I mean, that is infinitely many coupling constants, so that is not very predictive. We need the theory that's the full theory of quantum gravity. So the hope here, and this was represented by the asymptotic safety program, is that there is some non-Gaussian fixed point that actually saves us, and we are all good. Okay, so that was my second point of approach. But finally, I got a bit swayed beyond QFT, and I think I was very attracted to this fundamental discreteness idea, because spending many years doing functional analysis and dealing with divergences and all sorts of stuff, I thought, it would be great, you know, if the space-time was actually fundamentally discrete, then most of the things I worry about would not matter. Wouldn't that be great? I think there is a lot to be said for fundamental discreteness and, ideas of trying to understand the quantum nature of space-time itself, which I think lies in the foundation of several of the beyond QFT approaches. So I want to comment on it in a minute. But there are some things to consider, I mean, whether you go QFT or beyond QFT, which I think are important. So the question of Lorentzian signature. So a lot of results on both ends have been considered in Euclidean settings. And I think one important test of whether we are, you know, doing something fundamental or not is to see how things would change or can we actually do things Lorentzian. And I think we should keep that in mind, and as it was mentioned in the review by Astrid, of course there are now some results in Lorentzian asymptotic safety, but I think we should take Lorentzian signature very seriously in all these approaches. Background independence, and it doesn't completely rule out doing QFT approaches, but one has to keep in mind that whatever you do, in some sense, you want to be background independent, whether you want to show that things don't change if you perturb the background, they're so sort of covariant with respect to the background, whatever, but there is no, you know, prescribed background of the universe that you build your quantum gravity around. So somehow this has to be approached in all the QFT settings. Then the question of observables, which I actually find personally very fascinating. So and then you can argue whether you want some sort of gauge invariance, so whether you want your observables to be reparametrization or diffeomorphism invariant, which I like, but you can try to argue against it. That consideration pushed me kind of away from typical, you know, local observables and paradigm of local quantum field theory towards non-locality. So I think that is also quite clear that if you want to talk about gauge invariant observables, you have to give up locality. Now, if you give up locality, then you are already in a sort of beyond QFT framework, because traditionally QFT was developed as a local theory. One can argue that, of course, there are ways to generalize it, and as a mathematician, I sympathize with it. I think it's very interesting avenue of thinking, of research in quantum field theory as well, to go beyond locality. But it's something to keep in mind, that this fundamental principle of, say, traditional QFT has to go, in my opinion, somewhere. Okay, so these are the considerations. My own work in this area, it's essentially coming from algebraic QFT, so I use particular framework of you know, mathematical methods, and I try to apply it in effective quantum gravity, asymptotic safety, and also QFT on causal sets. So I find myself, like, I think, in the middle between QFT and beyond. So just to finish, what can we learn from each other? So I want to argue that, yes, QFT approaches deserve more spotlight. They were a bit in the shadow for a long time, so I think one should push things as far as we can. I mean, there is no reason not to, but one has to be aware of limitations, and I think that there is something in the beyond world, but I think when we are able to describe experimental results, when we have, like, fully consistent theory with all problems solved, then we can discuss who won the prize. Things that are, of course, very important to keep in mind in both sides of this discussion, we have to connect to the real world, so we have to see how things emerge from quantum gravity this way or the other. Going the other end, from quantum gravity to QFT, if we believe fundamental discreteness, it can actually work very nicely as a UV cutoff for QFT. So we can actually see what we can learn from that about, you know, the ways to regularize, to renormalize QFT, using, for example, QFT on causal sets to do that. And there are also some intersections between these different approaches. So, for example, you can use, this QFT on causal sets idea as a sort of implementing a Lorentz invariant UV cutoff, and then try to get some things in between. So that would be my dream, to actually be able to show that, you know, I mean, all these approaches can learn from each other, and although at the moment I'm a bit on the side of beyond, that doesn't mean that we should run away without looking back at QFT, and we should learn from what we have. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Kasia. And Pedro will like to
okay,
use
thank that. You.
So you can click once, and then I have a like overview slide.
Okay.
Can you click once?
Okay, very good. So I will just draw some kind of cartoonish ideas in the blackboard. I always prefer blackboard to slides. So sometimes, or often, in physics, we have some physical quantity, any physical quantity, say, and sometimes it can be defined or thought of as some integral over some fields, it with some action, typically with some Lagrangian, of that quantity. Now, by this schematically, when I say we integrate over fields, it could be something trivial, like spins. We have spins up and down, and we just sum over all possible spin configurations, like up and down. Or it can be string fields in string field theory, and we have to, in principle, sum over all possible string field configurations. It could be fields of the standard model, and so on. So I would separate the problem in saying, is it true that our physical quantity is computed by something of this sort? And it doesn't mean that it's easy to compute. Often, in most examples, the theory is strongly coupled. So what is my Lagrangian? It's some theory I understand well in the UV, plus some perturbation that triggers a flow to a very complicated theory. And it's very hard to follow. But still, I could say, in principle, this defines the theory. And so I would split this into two cases, yes or no, or at least not obviously. And what are some of the approaches that I would put in the yes box? For example, I would put in these approaches effective field theory, where we understand what we are doing. We had a beautiful review in the very first talk of the conference of the power of effective field theory as a way of predicting things, organizing physics by low energy. And we have other ideas like ADS-CFT, where we say that the theory that describes quantum gravity can also be described by a conformal field theory, et cetera, et cetera. And what would I put in the group of no? What would be something that a priori might not be? For example, I would say some explorations that people usually call bootstrap, which is the idea of instead of trying to think of the left-hand side as coming from something from like the right-hand side, we try directly to go to the physical quantity and ask, what are its physical properties? If I have an amplitude, it must produce reasonable probabilities, it must behave nicely at high energy, it must behave like this at low energy, and we try directly to constrain the physical quantity. And this bootstrap, there are many incarnations of it. Like Marx said, there is the conformal bootstrap, which is one where we try to study these critical theories that describe the fixed points of quantum field theories directly, be them strongly coupled or not. And of course, there is a connection between these approaches and these approaches. There is some region of overlap of both. So some CF, some conformal bootstrap problems, once we learn how to solve them, we can go and study them from usual CFT methods. And sometimes we want to study some CFT method, but we are not powerful enough, so we forget about path integrals and Lagrangians, and we go to study it from the bootstrap. There is the S-matrix bootstrap, where we say, no, I want to study scattering. Like we heard just before, often the scattering observables are good observables in quantum gravity, and I could just try to fix them directly instead of trying to compute them. And there are other examples of bootstrap. For example, a big field in physics of two dimensions is integrability, where we solve models. And often those models, we don't solve them by the Lagrangian, we solve them by immediately fixing the model based on constraints, on many constraints on its properties. And of course, these two things talk to each other. We start solving a model, then we realize it's integrable, then we forget about the Lagrangian and we go here. Or we start studying the space of models and we find some interesting models and ask whether they have a traditional description or not. And then there were two questions that Mark was asking, which is, what are some of the big challenges for these more esoteric approaches? And if I were to summarize to say one to two big challenges, I would say one is that usually when we do conformal bootstrap, we cannot compute as many things as in quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, you give me a quantum field theory, there's so many things I can compute. I can scatter, I can consider energy correlators, put some energy here, measure the probability of getting particles there. There are so many observables. And typically when we do bootstrap, we don't know how to define them. We start setting up some S-matrix bootstrap and we bootstrap the scattering of particles. But then you ask me a question that has nothing to do with scattering and we don't know. So that's one big problem, is being able to study all the quantities that we study here. Sometimes we have many quantities like scattering of two particles, scattering of three particles, non-local objects, etc. And here sometimes we are stuck. Say we study two particles and then we cannot do as many quantities as we could with usual quantum field theory. Now, if we don't overcome this object of being able to bootstrap everything, then this approach will never replace this approach. So that's a big obstacle. The other obstacle is just that things sometimes are hard. For example, it would be amazing if we could find, and this would be related to both these points that I mentioned here, to this approaches to ADS-CFT and approaches, say, to the conformal and even the S-matrix bootstrap as well. It would be amazing if we could find some CFT in three dimensions that would be the dual of our world. So our world would be equal to a conformal field theory. So even it's not like we would have to develop more esoteric things beyond quantum gravity and so on. We would go down in complexity and say, maybe our world is just a CFT. Now, for this to be even possible, what do we want of such CFT? We want a CFT where if you want to describe, say, pure gravity, what do we have in pure gravity? We have gravitons, and then we have a gap. Then we have massive stuff. And so constructing CFT3s with a big gap is a huge open problem. And it's a very simple problem to state. It's just take your approach to conformal field theory. It could be axiomatic quantum field theory. And axiomatic quantum field theory, is it quantum field theory in the standard sense? That some axioms, yes, some axioms, no. Some axioms are based on assumptions of locality and so on. Some other axioms implicitly assume that we have some sums like this. So it's a little bit in between both. And now we have the rules of conformal field theories. Say conformal field theories are easier to axiomatize than general quantum field theories. And you ask, can I construct a theory where I have a few operators with small dimensions, like 1, 2, 3, and then a big gap and operators of dimension 100, 200, a million, whatever. This we don't know. The CFTs we know that describe, say, Ising model, they have the sigma, the epsilon, and so on. They have many, many operators, and there's no such gap. And a beautiful fact is that we know some theories with this huge gap, but they are not the real world. So we know some supersymmetric quantum field theories that have this amazing property, that you study some states and then huge gap and then all the massive stuff. So they are a candidate for a toy model for a theory of quantum gravity, but of course it's not our world, it's a toy model, and it would be amazing to go beyond the toy model and find the CFT3. So I think these two points are two big challenges of any of these approaches, as far as more traditional approaches like ADS-CFT, the challenge, one of the main challenges is always establishing the dictionary and computing. Computing, you could say, maybe we just put the theory on a computer, we put n=4 on a computer, say, and we just simulate it, and that's fine. Maybe someone could do it with Monte Carlo or something, and indeed, some brave people like Anada and others have been doing that, and the results they find are really beautiful. But a huge challenge that we always have when we make statements like ADS is equal to CFT is establishing a dictionary, because knowing that the two theories are the same is a bit useless if I cannot translate an important question in quantum gravity to a CFT question. And there are questions that are amazing that we can answer. We can answer questions such as, what is a black hole state? Well, how do I see a black hole state in the CFT? What is it? It's very simple. It is just an operator with a huge dimension. But then there are more sophisticated questions, like what happens when I fall inside a black hole? What do I feel? And that we don't know how to translate to a CFT question. So that's a huge open problem, which the good news is that every year we develop the dictionary a little bit more. But establishing this dictionary, there are so many things we could try to explore, and definitely we don't have a full picture yet. Okay, so those would be my comments.
Right, great. Thank you very much, Pedro. Now it's, would you prefer
I'm fine.
To, you're fine? Okay.
I'm perfectly fine.
Okay.
More or less.
We have to
okay. be careful. Can you hear me if I talk?
The clicker? Lee, do you
want
to sit down?
I want a clicker. I will sit down at some point. But I can't see anybody. Okay, good. Now the first question that we're to address here is that we have the conflict between quantum field theories and beyond quantum field theories. And what do we mean by that? Well, I think, and Mark, you can tell me if this is really what you had in mind, is that for several years, we've drawn a distinction between background-independent theories and background-dependent theories. A background-dependent theory is any theory in quantum theory, let's stick ourselves to, in which we put some degrees of freedom on a structure which is not dynamical. So we pick a geometry, a topology, a metric, we fix all these things, and then we put some quantum fields or statistical variables on it and define the partition function and so on. So that's a background dependent theory. A background independent theory is a theory that doesn't use any assumptions about what the quote background is. A background independent theory is what Leibniz, the great philosopher, called the relational theory. It's a theory where all the degrees of freedom are dynamical and none are fixed a priori. So I know not everybody here will like this, and I apologize, but my view, and the view of many people in quantum gravity, is that to be a quantum theory of gravity, your theory has got to be a relational theory, which means it's got to be a background-dependent theory. And if you have a background-dependent theory, and we've seen a bunch of them today, there are many things that's useful. I have nothing against you all studying background-dependent theories, but you're not trying to make or discover the quantum theory of gravity. You're trying to do something else, which you're glad to do, but frankly, I'm not interested, because what you're doing is not advancing us towards finding the real background-dependent quantum field theory, or quantum theory of gravity. Okay, so I apologize to my friends, but that's what I'm interested in. Now, to build a background-dependent quantum field theory, you pick a geometry, a metric, etc. on it, to build a quantum theory of space and time, which is background independent, which is relational. You can't start the same way. How do you start? You can't start by fixing a geometry, because that's a background structure. You can't start by picking an asymptotic structure, because that's a background structure. And after you've thought about this for a while, you realize that what the world is asking you to do, to understand it, is to find a theory that creature constructs itself. That is, the theory of the world is a theory that can make itself. We don't make it. We give it something to help it. And you're going to think I'm crazy, but come over to Microsoft Research Labs where we're doing this. That is, we're making theories that develop themselves in the group of Jeanier, Lanier, and other people. So, that's one example is good enough. So you can look at our paper, and you can see how we make a quantum field theory that evolves itself. One way to say it, and I don't have time to draw out the consequences of this, is that our friends making quantum field theories were inventing dualities to construct their theory. And we want trialities. Maybe it sounds dumb, but there's a definition of triality in which you have the two things, position, momentum, that you had before, and you have a third thing, which turns out to be time. That is, the reason why you need a triality is you need time to manufacture the universe on its own, which leads to a last moral of these things, which is that there are two kinds of computing languages, say. There are computing languages that make themselves, and or you can make them if they can make themselves. Let me not confuse you. There are computing programs or models which we make. We can just write them down and run them, and we know what's going on. Those are like background-dependent theories. And there are, I'm almost done, there are theories that make themselves, and we cannot make them, which is to say that we can set up the revolution, but we can't predict every facet of where that evolution will go. Now, that's well known in logic and computer science, systems that evolve that way. That corresponds to systems, Gödel-like systems, that you can't compute in advance where they're going to go. And those are the kinds of systems that we're looking for. We're looking for systems that do not, you cannot make the world in two pieces. You cannot say, let's make the laws. Well, there are the laws, they're there, let's figure out everything they're going to do. And now let's run the system. We know what's going to happen. Those are systems without time, because you can run the system entirely after you've understood it entirely. And then there are systems which cannot construct without running them. And you can't do that in a finite amount of time. And those are systems whose very running are the other evolution by time. Okay, I think I said everything I wanted to. But let me just thank you. This is a lot else, but let me answer one question. Supposing you want to make a quantum theory of gravity, a real genuine one, then you have to build a system, as I said, that evolves itself, but you have to do a bunch of other things which are more conventional. And I don't have time to go into it now, but quantum gravity theories, which I'll say are interesting, are those quantum gravity theories that are background independent, that are diffeomorphism invariant, and that in a certain sense will make themselves. And I think there are a few which may go that way. I think causal sets may go that way. I think loop quantum gravity may go that way. And I think that maybe causal sets, sorry. So causal dynamical triangulations, causal sets, or something like loop quantum gravity. And if you give me more time, I can explain why I make those distinctions. But let me just close by saying that there are not many of us pursuing this program, which is a kind of outflow of loop quantum gravity. So come and join us, and we're having a lot of fun, and come join us. Thank you.
All right, let's thank all the panelists for the opening statements first. Thank you, Lee. And so are there immediate reactions from maybe the more QFT side to the non-QFT side, also from Pedro towards statements that were made from Luca?
I can ask a question to Pedro. Like, I'm not, of course, familiar with ADS-CFT, but still I find interesting what you said about if one could construct like a CFT tree, and then maybe one can get some knowledge about like four-dimensional space-time physics. But here still we will have some negative cosmological constant. So are you imagining that the real world is, in the end, going to be described by some negative cosmological constant?
Yeah. So indeed. So I was super general with dot, 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 and phi could be everything. So I kind of encapsulated more or less everything you could think of. Except, I think there's something that really doesn't fit in the kind of things I said, which is cosmology. So cosmology, I don't have anything smart to say. So I started learning about gravity and black holes recently, so eventually I will get to cosmology, I hope, during my career, but cosmology is very tough. Now, I don't believe that to describe some aspects of quantum gravity that we need cosmology, at least that's my hope. I don't think to describe this room or to describe the solar system that we cannot put it in a box. Normally, if you have some physical system, if we want, we can put it in a box and things don't change that much. So I believe that if you want to describe that, if it's possible in some scenarios to just consider a big box that's much bigger than what you want to study, then I believe that for those type of problems, I really find ADS-CFT, for me personally, the most promising approach. But if you ask me, do I have anything smart to say about cosmology within ADS-CFT? No. That's a different type of questions that some people tried. I mean, like, there are many speculative ideas, analytically continuing ADS to flip the sign or trying to put some, but it's something I don't know much, and there are people that know much more. I don't know. Neil, I think, worked on it, and but that's a huge challenge. I think there are many, many huge puzzles there. But even though I think they are huge and super tough, they are still, to me, much simpler than cosmology. Cosmology looks very hard.
Would you agree that any cosmological theory must be a theory of the single closed universe?
I don't know enough. I don't have a bias towards one answer or the other. Let me just say that one of the things that I find interesting about this, about saying that perhaps our world, suppose we take our world, at least in a region where flat space is a good approximation, we put it in a huge box, then this defines a CFT3. And maybe you could prove this is wrong. You could show, you take the rules of CFT and you show, no, there exists no CFT without supersymmetry that has a big gap. Then you would say what I'm saying is nonsense, because you would show these theories don't exist. So what am I saying? That I put on a box and I get a CFT? On the contrary, if you try to do this exercise and you could show some result like this, you could say, oh, maybe this is evidence for supersymmetry. I would not buy it, but you could say such words. And if you find it, amazing, then you have a new theory that would be a candidate for a new theory of quantum gravity. So it's a very tough problem, but it's very well posed and it's very constructive.
I actually have a comment to Lee. I very strongly agree with that quantum gravity should be background independent and it should be relational. I believe that's true. In my head, however, it doesn't entirely rule out quantum field theory approaches, because you can imagine the way of formulating things so that you have some observables that you build starting from quantum field theory approaches, and then you show that they are background independent and formulate your true theory in terms of relations between these observables. So the way I imagine it is like we have GR, which is geometrical and obviously independent of a coordinate system, but you know, when we do computations, sometimes it's useful to pick up a coordinate system and to write things down in coordinates. But it doesn't mean that, you know, what we compute in GR is coordinate dependent. We know that, you know, it isn't. So I think a sort of nice way of kind of, you know, connecting these things would be to actually focus on aspects of QFT-based approaches which are background independent or can lead to background independent relational observables to kind of get some glimpses of what the beyond QFT theory could look like. Thank you.
I think you have to think about it long enough till you see why being background independent means the time must be real. And that's something that is a key step. I mean, it took me and some of the people I'm working with 25 or 30 years to develop this way of thinking. And
obvious?
No, it's not obvious.
But can you maybe like make an argument for that?
Sure.
Yeah.
There's a property that, let me remember how to put it. There's a property that no mathematical object has that the world has, which proves, when I tell you what that property is, it proves that the world is not a mathematical object. It is not isomorphic to a mathematical object. And that property itself is to be at one time, each time. That is, you can't find a piece of nature that is not undergoing change. And that's either spurious, and if it is spurious, then we can go back to older styles of theories where things are finite and static. Or if that's intrinsic, then we have to figure out how to build new kinds of theories, and I suggest this by building themselves, analogous to logics that are non... I forget my words, but...
Yeah, so I think what you're arguing is... I mean, going farther than that, it's not against... it's farther than against QFT approaches. It's more... I mean, you're ascribing fundamental meaning to change and,
yes,
and to time. So that is actually much more radical than some of the even beyond,
yes,
QFT approaches, if I understand. So that, I mean,
I think you have to take, you have to, it's not easy, but I think you have to take that route. And I mean, it sounds stupid, but, you know, Roberto Unger and I spent five years writing a carefully worded book on this issue. So
I'm familiar with that. Yeah. So would you say that causal set theory has that feature? Can it describe change in the fundamental way? Would you say that this fits your paradigm or?
Let's take it two things and one thing at a time. Causal set theory can be formulated in some kind of trivial way, mm-hmm, in which it has a trivial dynamics. If you follow that a little bit, it should be a finite theory. And so we have a finite dynamical system. Mm-hmm. Dynamical systems which are finite either go to limit sets, right, or they go off the page, so to speak. So, well, that's the beginning of the argument.
Mm-hmm. Benny wants to
comment. I think I have a follow-up question to Lee. I think there are different levels of background independence, and I think you're really on the radical end, but what speaks against, you want to throw out all the background structure that you could write down, but what speaks against, like, saying, okay, you have your simulation or whatever, your computation, you get some expectation value of some kind of, let's call it geometry, and now suddenly you have something to hold on to. Why don't you use that? So you know that you have to produce something like that to, you know, describe the real world. Why do you not assume that this exists and then you can work with it? Like on a practical level?
What you're asking me to believe is that real numbers exist. That's how deep I want to go. I don't think real numbers exist.
Sorry, could you repeat?
I don't believe that real numbers exist. I think that a number that you cannot specify doesn't exist, but every real number, almost every real number, cannot be specified in a finite description. And my view, which is not everybody's, but is consistent with many people's in foundations of mathematics, is that if you can't completely specify a mathematical object, it doesn't exist. And that's where I stop. Now, you may disagree with that, and many people do disagree with that. And let's see, I mean, we're here. I'm not begging you, I'm not saying you must work on my direction, but I'm saying that I found an interesting direction to start off in. And it's very compelling once you, in my opinion.
Sorry, you're saying that if something, it's working, if some mathematical object does not exist, it does not have like a, cannot explain some reality of our world, that's what you're saying?
If some, I'm sorry. You say again what?
Sorry, are you saying that, because I don't know if I heard, are you saying that if some mathematical object does not really make sense,
yes,
it cannot be used to describe the real world? That's what you
sure
said?
Sure. Why did we learn all this mathematics?
But is that what you said, right?
Yes.
But I mean, I don't, maybe we're giving too much importance to mathematics, right? I mean, mathematics is just a tool for us.
No, it's not just a tool.
I think so.
Mathematics is a way of,
you see, I mean, let's
drawing the limit between what can exist and be fully described and what cannot be.
I'm
and
not
there
sure
are a lot of things that we speak about that it turns out they can, look, all of these things can be tools, they can be games, and people want to play the game of effective field theory or finite causal sets or anything like that, they're welcome to. My expectation, and it's only my expectation, is that that's not the way to get to the truth about nature for reasons that I've written some substantial amount about and I'm trying to work out.
I think I would...
But I could be totally wrong.
Maybe we're also drifting slightly in a philosophical
oh, you
direction.
Have to.
So.
Can we change the name of this panel?
Actually, I want... Yeah, Benny, do you...
I have a challenge for Kasia. So you mentioned that you more and more believe into fundamental discreteness, but so at least my expectation is that you need some kind of universality, like second-order phase transition, to know, to not depend on microscopic details. So, but if you now have fundamental discreteness, how do you make sure that if I change, I don't know, a little bit the microscopic degrees of freedoms, that you don't get completely different infrared physics?
Yeah, I think this is the question of emergence. So obviously that's the challenge of you know, discrete or like fundamentally quantum space-time approaches. Or causal dynamical triangulations. So it is, of course, a challenge to show how the macroscopic physics emerges. I think, in all these approaches, there are already some results kind of going in that direction. So the fact that we don't observe these microscopic effects in our scales, it doesn't mean that they are not there. So the idea is that at the scale that we observe the universe at the moment, we don't see these effects yet. But I think the challenge would be to look for the signatures of fundamental discreteness that you can actually, you know, find in the nearest future. I think there are already some ideas from the causal set theory how to describe cosmology and how to look for cosmological observables, cosmological data, and try to compare it with causal set models. So, but the notion of like emergence of physical laws and various effects at different scales. I think that that's something that we know happens in physics. Okay, I mean we have effective theories, or we have theories that describe universe very well in certain regimes of certain constants, certain couplings. I could go into philosophical divagations as well, but I think the question is here. What we are trying really to achieve, right? I mean, if we are trying to build a quantum theory of gravity, obviously we do have to connect to known physics. I'm definitely not questioning that.
So when you have in mind like discreteness, you always think about some Planck length discreteness, or is like something even below?
I mean, it could be something even lower. I think fundamentally what I really like about causal sets is that there is this notion of what's fundamental sort of thing in describing physics, and there, you know, there's this notion of events. So if you distill what's kind of important in GR or in quantum field theory even, right, you have causality. This is there. And if you say that, okay, I want to strip away everything and have only the sort of bare bones of what the theory should have, I would say events, so things that happen, plus the causality relations, which kind of allow us to reconstruct the notion of causality that we observe. So that's for me, it's a very minimal setup to say what a space-time sort of in the small scales in discrete should be. So then you can try to argue, well, okay, if we want to describe this or that, maybe we have to add extra structure, okay? But I would say like the first sort of go at it should be to start with really the fundamental pieces and try to build things bottom up. So that's how I see, and this is a personal perspective.
Sure, no, because I mean, a more minimal approach, I mean, at least in my opinion, would be just what is, let's say, at the classical level that we call gravity, usually some gravitational field, right? Some field.
Okay. But that could be an effective description,
right? It could
right?
be, mm-hmm. sure, an effective description, but I would try to worry and try to understand whether we can make sense of a quantum description of this field. And then, okay, you can say maybe you quote microscopic scales and there could be something mm-hmm. popping up. But still, this idea that very often we hear, like, if you want to understand quantum gravity, you have to quantize space-time, mm-hmm. in the sense of, like, really quantize something and get some discreteness, is really, like, in the end, some physical concept. Because if we think of a discreteness like a structure of the space-time, mm-hmm. where you would say, okay, I have just Planck length cells in my space-time. I mean, in a way, you will never be able to access really those regions, because somehow you will need anyway energy scale or the order of Planck scale, and if you do that, you would. Anyway,
I mean, that's if you want to access it from accelerator physics. Yes.
No, even like I don't know, some you can imagine to access this discreteness. Discrete structure, okay, you will have to probably maybe high energy and so short wavelength, short length scales, and somehow you will have some limitation due to black hole formation, for instance, because if you want to probe like high energy for small scales, and so it's just a concept maybe that will not be even accessible physically.
I would say that infinities are usual, I mean, in general, infinities are a very awkward thing physically, but very useful thing mathematically. Okay, so we think about, you know, Minkowski space-time as something infinite. We think about, you know, continuum, so we can zoom in infinitely small, right? I mean, these are useful mathematical tools, but, you know, it's very hard to meet infinities in nature. It's very hard to actually, I mean, convincingly argue that everything is kind of, you know, that there is no small structure of space-time, because, I mean, yeah, I mean, what we can study is actually approximations and certain physical regimes, right? So in a certain physical situation, we know that we can model it using a certain mathematical model, right? Which approximates our, you know, it's a picture of that piece of the universe, mm-hmm. right? It approximates something. It's not the ultimate truth about something. Sorry for going in the philosophical direction
My bias point is just that, for instance, we want to maybe extrapolate, and so imagine that something could happen in a regime where we cannot really, we are extrapolating about some regime, okay, mm-hmm. from where we don't get any indication from nature, because, I mean, no one is telling us that space-time must be discrete. And of course, there are, I think, infinite possibilities to extrapolate about things that we cannot access. So in this sense, yeah.
I mean, it's as bad to extrapolate that there is no, I mean, it's not necessarily better to extrapolate that there is no finer structure, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, these are both us and physical in a sense, because...
Oh, that's why maybe one could maybe work a bit higher. Sorry, please.
I think Illy wants to say something.
Just if you add to your fundamental things, energy and momentum and your conservation, you can do much, much more, including see cleanly space emerge. Mm-hmm. And form a space-time with the time that was already there fundamentally.
Mm-hmm. So that's your notion of energy causal sets, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to this different extrapolation, that's exactly where universality comes into play, right? So the point is, okay, you have all these extrapolations, but in the end they have the same infrared physics. So that's, in a sense, what you want.
Well, these are the models we're playing with, but if you want to, sure.
Well, it's a good feature, at least to work with in practice.
Well, I'm not trying to predict something in that sense. I'm trying to play with models and see what kinds of games are possible, what the things invent. And so when I know how to set up a model without space, with time, and watch it evolve in such a way that space emerges. That's a little game that we've discovered these systems can play. And that's satisfying. But I wouldn't say right away, you know, we have found out how space emerges, because it might or might not, and there might be many other ways that space emerges. But it's very interesting to see how these things can work.
So as much as I would like to keep this going, we are running, time is approaching to its end. The session is approaching to its end. So let's maybe open the discussion to the audience, and let's see if there are questions to either of the panelists from the audience. And I think Renate has raised her hand.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. I think there is some... maybe misunderstanding in this discussion about fundamental discreteness versus universality. I mean, the aim typically, this is how one phrases it, right? We hope there is something like a essentially unique theory of quantum gravity that's valid at the Planck scale, and that is essentially unique there as a fundamental theory. So when Benjamin was talking about universality, I think that's the universality he meant. He didn't mean, So if one has something like causal sets, then I think the way I understand what practitioners of this approach say, well, this is the Planckian theory. This is it. It's not an approximation and, you know, let me flow to low energies and I'm only interested in that. No, you know, of course, one hopes then there are also, of course, consequences for observables, but in a way that's a different question. But I think this type of formulation where you postulate some Planckian structure and declare this to be the theory has exactly the problem that Benjamin was talking about. Because how do you justify, you know, the squares instead of the triangles? And I think in causal sets, of course, one was always looking, maybe, is there a unique dynamics that would, of course, be something very nice to say, already help us on the way to make things not just so arbitrary and depend on so many free parameters. But I think this hasn't been found yet. But I think it's not good enough to say, oh, you know, whatever I choose there, I get the same low energy physics out. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in the universal quantum theory. So, Kasia, you have to sharpen your argument, I think.
Let me just make one trivial comment that, of course, we don't know what theory describes nature, but I think we already know it's not unique. Because we have examples of UV completions of gravity. They might not be related to the theory that describes the world, but ADS-CFT and string theory, for example, they UV complete gravity, and it's a well-defined theory that would be a UV completion. It's a different question of whether that's the theory of nature. I would not bet. That would be a very long shot, but uniqueness, I think, is ruled out. The theory of quantum gravity is not unique.
No, I'm talking about physical theories realized in nature. Let me make this.
No, but then by definition, whatever theory is the theory of nature is the theory of nature. Then there is no sense of uniqueness. There is one theory. We don't have two theories.
Occam's razor.
But we should not be looking for uniqueness.
Occam's razor, and we don't have, you know, a whole zoo of theories with arbitrary many parameters, which we still have to fix by making experiments. So in that sense, one would hope that nature is sufficiently kind so that we discover a description of quantum gravity which has maybe a few parameters, three parameters.
A quick comment, or we have also more questions?
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, a question for Pedro. In your no category up there, you have bootstrap solutions which are consistent but which are not describable by a Lagrangian. Does that mean that if we were to go out and do some measurements in maybe not our world, but some world, that there'd be theories that we could never describe by a Lagrangian? So that it'd be totally outside of our present understanding of quantum field theory. Secondarily, if it's not a Lagrangian structure, is there some underlying structure that can be used to describe those solutions?
Right. Yeah, so of course, I don't know the answer to that question. It's a question of whether, if we axiomatize sufficiently the quantities we want to compute, whether we can drop completely Lagrangians. Now, the progress that has been done in looking, say, for critical points of matter, right, and for fixed points of matter that describe real materials and at the critical point, there it seems to work. We know which axioms are powerful enough. Associativity, unitarity seem to be powerful enough in some cases to basically replace Lagrangian theories. But then there is a basic question, which is often we know I want to study this theory and I don't want to study the space of theories and look for my theory. I want to, from the beginning, I say I want to study this material, this theory, and to develop the bootstrap to that level of detail that I can, from the very beginning, know exactly which theory I study is very hard. So if I study a theory which has very little symmetry, for example, and if I don't have some global symmetries or some flavor symmetries, and then there will be many, many theories that will be in the allowed space of theories, and it will be challenging to pinpoint which one it is. It's possible that it's, so there are things we can do that I think we cannot yet do with the usual Lagrangian theories. There are results on the bootstrap, on the space of some theories for which we don't know Lagrangians, but we have some indirect arguments from string theory that they should exist, for example. There are CFTs that we don't know where they flow from the RG, but people in condensed matter argue independently for their existence. And And in a sense, it's also not so different from a usual quantum field theory, where we start doing computations and we use some experiments to fix parameters, right? So like you were explaining. It could be similar. It could be that it's a little bit of version of that, but more non-perturbative, where I say I need to fix the value of the amplitude in some energy range with some precision. Given that, I can predict all amplitudes in all energies. Those type of questions, I think it's very possible that the bootstrap could become good enough to pinpoint. But just to be very concrete, there is one very basic. I mentioned there are two bootstrap problems that I think are of comparable complexity, the conformal and the S-matrix bootstrap. And there's something that, if I want to also be very concrete, in something that we don't know how to do in the S-matrix bootstrap for now, which is a complexity that's much harder than in the CFT language, is to describe many particles. So it's very easy to do scattering of two particles, two gravitons, two electrons, whatever. But if you want to describe many particles going on, the kinematics are so complicated that we have very little clues for how does a theory of even five, six, say 2 to 4 gravitons, what are the analytic properties of a scattering amplitude for 2 to 4? We know so little about it. It's very, very hard. So that I would say is a bit technical obstacle. If we only if we cannot go beyond 2 to 2 particles, this bootstrap, I think, will be dead.
I actually might want to follow up on the bootstrap. So you mentioned that you have to specify the symmetries. And so do you also have to specify the fundamental degrees of freedom of a theory? Or can you infer that just from the symmetry structure? Or is that something you put in?
No, typically in the bootstrap, the variables are the emergent variables.
Okay.
So I don't care if some material is effectively made of electrons. I care about the long distance physics, for example, when I'm studying a CFT.
Okay.
Or when I'm studying scattering of globules, I don't care that the globules are made of gluons. I care that there exists some asymptotic state with some mass, and that's what I would input in the bootstrap.
But so in the end, you also wouldn't know what the fundamental degrees are. You only know their, like...
I would rather try, but that's possibly true for some questions, but I would always caution that I would prefer if that question came with a physical quantity, with a puzzle, right? Because saying words like, is this ontological or whatever, I mean, it's too abstract, right? So if there is a... And that's related to my question that I said, for example, we could be able to do scattering. We could go to very large distances and scatter globules or scatter gravitons and so on. But then you could ask about short distance experiments that are not scattering and that we could also do in the real world. And those might probe different degrees of freedom than the asymptotic ones, and they might be very hard to address.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. I have a very quick follow-up question. So in the sort of ideal world where you complete that program and you find this CFT3, is it dual to a theory which in a sense would be background independent? Like, how do you envisage this kind of, you talked about scatterings and particles, which of course makes sense on like Minkowski space-time picture, but I think that you meant something more general than that. So I was wondering what would that be? How do you see it?
Yeah. So one way of seeing different backgrounds is suppose I have a theory and I am in the CFT3 and then I compute correlation functions, which means I put probes at a bunch of points. Mm-hmm. That describes probes in empty ADS space. Now, if I take two of these probes to be very heavy, they will back react on the geometry and describe now a new background. And I have two options. Either I start with ADS, put some very heavy probes, and compute the remaining n-2 probes, or I start directly from the new background and do the computation with the n-2 probes. If they are the same, I would say we have background independence.
Very quickly, in general relativity with cosmological boundary conditions, so there's no ADS, there's no DS, there's just compact. It's a theorem that there are no conservation laws. There are no non-zero conservation laws. Kukash, 1972, roughly.
Again, if you translate that to a physical statement for a physical observable,
Maybe I could try to understand what exactly you mean. So you are saying that
if the universe
to define
is
quantum
closed,
gravity on a sphere is hard?
Yes.
Okay. Fine. Maybe.
We have a question by Fernando up there.
Yes. A question. Sorry, question for Pedro again. So Bootstrap was very popular 60 years ago, and now it was revived. Can you tell us in a few minutes or a few seconds what is the progress being made and why now?
Yeah, so I think that one obvious thing why it was revived was computers. Was just that the basic idea of the Bootstrap is to scan over possibilities, and you scan using computers. So when your computers are bad, you cannot do scans. So that's one practical thing. The other thing is that when you study the space of theories, it's very useful to have lampposts, points that you understand well. And since then, we understood, for example, integrable theories. So in two dimensions, when we start carving out these spaces, we have points, special points that are strongly coupled that must be detected. Even when we study scattering amplitudes in four dimensions, the amount of progress that has been done in studying perturbative scattering amplitudes is huge, so we learn much more about its potential analytic properties. So I would say that the fact that the Lagrangian methods have been developed so much gives us more knowledge about the expected analytic properties of the quantity we want to bootstrap. That's one thing. The second thing is computers. It's the fact that we have better techniques. Maybe one third thing is the conformal bootstrap. There were ideas that came from the conformal bootstrap. When I say computers, I could be precise. What exactly do I mean by that? Because there are particular numerical techniques that were developed in the conformal bootstrap that we could import to the S-matrix bootstrap. But maybe one last thing. It's also that why did we start with a bootstrap and we abandoned? Because there was a ton of awesome perturbative things to compute, right? I mean, quantum chromodynamics appears, and we want to study things that are well predicted by the asymptotically free regime, and it was a festival, right? With so many amazing things to compute. And now we are left with the hard questions. Now we want to go back to the non-perturbative questions and ask if I have a strongly coupled scattering of, say, the lightest glue ball in QCD, what is the result?
Can you say what has been achieved from the recent years that people couldn't do before? I mean, something concrete?
In the S-matrix bootstrap? Yeah, so for example, a type of questions that we ask often is when you have a theory at low energy, and then there are corrections to that theory in the that organize themselves in effective field theory. The coefficients of these effective field theory terms are called Wilson coefficients. And now you could ask, how big or small do these need to be? And so, for example, there are predictions that say, if you have, let me give you the simplest possible example. If you have a flux tube, when the flux tube is very long, it's approximately described by Nambu-Goto. It's a theory of a very long string. It's just effective field theory of a long string. The first correction to Nambu-Goto, it's a precise Wilson coefficient. Let's call it gamma. Gamma needs to be bigger than -1/768. That's an example of a quantity that I don't know how to prove this using perturbative methods. It's an example of one analytic result. There are similar results in higher dimensions, but they are numerical. They are not. I cannot tell you the analytic number.
Luca?
Sorry, if I can follow up very quickly on that. So if I'm not wrong, the whole point of the S-matrix bootstrap approach in the 60s and 70s was to understand strong interaction, right? And but in the end, at least it looks like that in those years, then asymptotic freedom was discovered, and that was actually a good way to understand what was going on. Now, somehow this bootstrap has been revived again, but then if we know that already quantum field theory has done very well there, why we should go back to the bootstrap and try to understand strong interaction?
No, because let me give you a very simple example. Take F square, just the simplest possible theory you could imagine, just pure glue. Take a simple gauge group, like SU2. And you go to Wikipedia, you see there are three glue balls. And the ratio of the second glue ball to the first glue ball is like 1.17. We have no idea how to compute this number. It's a strongly coupled number. It's a pure number. We should be able to compute it, and we have no idea. So to say that in principle the Lagrangian is enough, and in principle I could simulate it with Monte Carlo, and in principle, gluons as fundamental degrees of freedom describe the theory. It's true, but it's a bit useless at low energy. So if I want to ask what's the scattering of glue balls, what's the spectrum of glue balls, it's not a theory. It's not that useful to know what that the microscopic world is described by gluons.
It could be that, I don't know, some non-perturbative feature of quantum field theory could try to answer those questions, right?
People try this. People try, let's study in perturbation theory, but say, resum many, many processes that we believe could be the ones that become relevant at higher energy. It becomes very quickly very phenomenological because it's very hard to do it, right? I mean, it's how, in principle, yes, you could ask, you could start studying a two-point function of f squared in Fourier space. There will be a poles. The poles will be the glue balls. But you cannot see these poles. Now you have to resum many, many graphs and try to start seeing them, assume they are there, make an approximation, some Padere summation. There are, of course, things you can try. But then it's great that you have another approach, which is the bootstrap that says that given what we know about this and this experiment, this ratio needs to be between this and this. Even if you will later develop other techniques, it's super powerful to have bounds from bootstrap that can guide you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I think we have time for one last question from Zoom.
Yes, there were two online questions for Luca regarding renormalizability. One was whether renormalizability should be a subjective criterion and why nature should care whether we can compute something or not. And then related to this, shouldn't unitarity be as fundamental as renormalizability?
So can you repeat the first part, actually?
Why should
nature care about renormalizability or not? Sure. I mean, I think we should distinguish a bit like theory and the description of nature, right? I mean, I think, at least from my understanding, we observe the world and we try to explain it with like mathematical theories. And at least in the framework QFT, okay, if you want to do that, of course, in principle, you can have infinite type of Lagrangian, right? You can have infinite type of interaction terms. So I think theoretically to start with, you should have some guiding principle. So with this guiding principle, you can select some Lagrangian and then try to test this Lagrangian. And if this Lagrangian may contradict some of the experiments, then you go back to your starting principle and maybe you touch and change something. Now, at least I think from my point of view, a great success of the framework QFT in the last century was, I'll say, this criterion of strict renormalizability, which is very powerful to select theories, given some number of fields, some dimension, which in this case would be d equal to 4 and so on. And the most natural thing to do from my point of view would be, okay, let's try to do the same to gravity, with gravity. And if you do that with gravity to describe perturbative feature, you get a Lagrangian, which is, again, strictly renormalizable. And with that, you can do experiment. Now, what is really fundamental about this renormalizability principle, who knows? But I think that as a tool to select theories in the perturbative QFT framework, in my opinion, has been very successful so far. Not only without gravity, but also with gravity. And one example is that, as I said before, you would generate other terms in your Lagrangian which are needed for the renormalizability. And actually, this term can be even useful to describe some physics that goes beyond Einstein general relativity, like, for instance, inflation. Okay. So in this sense, I mean, I think the question of, like, why nature should care about renormalizability, of course, should not care. Maybe one can use something else and try to describe things. But still, I think quantum field theory with this principle, guiding principle, can be very successful in describing what we have observed so far, at least. Of course, this is not the full story. There can be more. And it could be that, I don't know, one day we will see that maybe renormalizability is not enough even to describe perturbative quantum field theories, and we have to do something else. But so far, I think it has been successful from my perspective. Right. Yeah.
Let me just say that, like, 99.9% of theories we know are effective field theories. And but at low energies, we don't see these extra terms, but they are there. If I increase the energy and I do some standard model experiment, I start seeing some
dimension 5, dimension 6. Your belief that you would see something, right? But if you take just the standard model Lagrangian, they are strictly normalizable.
That's what you have.
Yeah, but I would not say that, and the logic is that is you should quantize the standard model Lagrangian, but rather that the theory always has all possible terms that you can write, but at low energy, only some matter.
Sure, but this is, I would say, a different point of view, where you say, okay, my theory standard model is just an effective field theory, and there are like lots of other terms which I'm neglecting. This is, I think, a point of view, but from my side, I'm saying, let's try to be cheaper and more unique in the description of our Lagrangian, because of course, if you have infinite terms, you can do everything you want because you have an infinite number of parameters. But I think the strong point of the strict romanizability criterion is that once you require it, you have a finite number of interaction terms that you can write down. And if, for instance, we say, okay, I don't want strict romanizability, I want to have super romanizability, that's not good because with gravity we'll have an infinite options. So it's really the strict romanizability where we have this dimensionless coupling that govern the UV behavior of your theory, okay, is a very important, I think, constraining criteria because it gives you more unique choice for your interaction term in the Lagrangian. And you may say, I don't care about uniqueness, but I think if you really want to do, in the end, you want to match, let's say, theories with experiment, if you want to try to like discriminate between theories, we need more unique, we need principle which gives more unique, let's say, possibilities. Because in this way, if the theory contradicts the experiment, then you can go easily back and then change your starting point. But if you have many theories, you would say, okay, let's now discard this theory, we go to another theory, and so on. So I think the power of this strict normalizability criterion is that you have like more unique options, and somehow they've been working very well so far.
All right. Since we're already running over time, I think the last statement about in the end we have to connect to experiment and like closes the circle that we had a couple of times in this conference already. So let's close the panel, and actually I thank all my panelists for the nice opening statements and for the nice discussions throughout. So, and yeah, so let's maybe give them a hand.